Shop the Sherwin-Williams sale and get 30% off Duration, Woodscapes, and SuperDeck products May 1st through the 11th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Trailblaze. I'm Jamal Simmons here with my fantastic host and co-host, Matt Butler. We, as you know, are the first podcast talking about the 2028 campaign. And we are joined today by Jesse Lehrer, who launched the first newsletter focused on the 2028 campaign. He also is a co-host of the newsletter is called Nobody's Listening. And he is the co-host of a podcast called Nobody's Knows Anything. Did I get that right, Jesse?
Yeah, we just tried to make it as confusing as possible. Just trying to make it as confusing as possible for you. That is correct.
Nobody's Listening. Right. Nobody's Listening is the newsletter, and Nobody Knows Anything is the podcast. Right? Am I right?
Yes. Yes. It would have made more sense if it was the other way around, I guess. But here we are.
Great.
You know,
they're both great.
Thank you.
And you have the joy of doing that with Mr. Flaherty, who I know.
That's right.
From my time in the government. He's a good dude.
We're just trying to follow in your guys' footsteps here.
No, we are. Yeah, there's a lot of real estate out here.
There's a lot to talk about. There's a lot of storylines.
Matt, how are you doing this week? You doing all right?
I'm doing great. We got lots to talk about, and we should dive in.
All right, let's do it.
I'm happy to have Jesse here.
Let's do it. There's a big story, Jesse, you pointed out, I think we should get started with, because I think it matters a lot. There'll be a lot of people in different lanes. There's always a conversation in presidential politics about which lane is any candidate running in. And there's a great contest people are fascinated by who will fill the Bernie Sanders lane in 2028. The two big names that came up, Ro Khanna and AOC. I mean, what do you think about that? You spend a lot of time out here in these Democratic streets.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it is to me one of the most interesting and biggest questions of this 2028 campaign. You know, Bernie put together a coalition and a movement that kind of is without equal right now in the Democratic Party. There's not really another figure or another obvious, like, delineated movement that I think packs the same punch as Bernie. You know, he's been a major player in a lot of these primaries that are playing out at the Senate level and House level. And, you know, I think AOC is sort of the natural inheritor to that movement and has been teed up as such for many years. She's insanely charismatic and super talented communicator, you know, and at the same time, there is a segment of that left side that is not entirely sold on her, you know, that thinks she is a pragmatic sellout, as they are wont to determine people are.
Amazing.
And she just, it's also very unclear still whether, you know, I think she could basically walk into Chuck Schumer's Senate seat, you know, which that may look like a more appealing thing to do as a, you know, she's only about, I think, 36 years old. So it'll be really interesting to see how it plays out. But I think that it's there for the taking. And because it's not as saturated as the sort of centrist-ish lane, I don't know if there's going to be just like a center and a progressive lane, but, like, you know, you look at Josh Shapiro and Pete Buttigieg and Gavin Newsom. There's a lot more players in the other side of the field. And so I think if she runs, she's got a really good shot to kind of, you know, assume a bunch of that Bernie movement, and that might be enough to make a really serious play for the nomination if 20, 30, 40, 50 people are running.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, Matt, I'd love to hear how you think about this. The thing about AOC that is the most compelling is that she's the most compelling, right? Yeah. You don't really have to like wonder when you see her on TV whether or not she's interesting, because you can't like, you know, you can't look away. She says the right thing. She talks about interesting stuff. You know, she's the one who said last week, she was asked whether or not we'll have a first woman president, the first gay president. And she said, I don't know. Have we already had the first gay president? Can't say that we haven't. we don't know. So I just find her to be interesting every time she shows up on camera. Matt, what do you think?
I agree with you completely. I do think that you are going to have the situation where people play pundit, like voters play pundit and be like, AOC, I don't know. She's young. She's way out here. I don't think she can win. And then you're going to have a big segment of people who may like her and don't vote for her. So I think that is probably her biggest kind of downside right now, is just people like, oh, you know, we've done this Hillary. And then Kamala Harris, like, we can't do this again. Like, you hear that a lot. I don't agree with it, but you hear that a lot. So I think that's her biggest downside. And I think also really centrist folks are very scared of Bernie. They still think that Bernie is an absolute insane socialist. They think AOC is insane. They think Mondani is insane. I disagree with it. I can see both sides of this argument. I don't know who's going to win out. But I think AOC is going to have a lot of pushback. And I also think, you know, maybe she'd be better in the Senate. Like, it'd be a really nice place. She could be there for many years. You could have, a bigger influence than she could, you know, if she runs and loses for president. So,
I don't know. I mean, look, I think we'll get you back in here. I think that she is a brand name, and in an America where attention spans are super short, having a brand name matters. Hillary was a brand name. Kamala is a brand name, AOC. So I think people know like who this person is, and then they may already have some opinions about her, but you got to change people's minds. I don't know. Jesse, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's one of the real differentiators here, right? Is like, she's got that attention capital and star power that is really lacking for, you know, there's for all the hot takes that you see, and we love a good intra-party fight in the Democratic Party, but for all the, like, you know, you would think on Twitter that Josh Shapiro and like that these people are radioactive and half of America loves them and half of America hates them. And in reality, 90% of America
have no idea
who they are. and AOC is kind of, you know, one of the few figures, you know, outside of Trump and Bernie in modern American politics who really has that sort of outsized place in the American mind, you know?
So one thing that's come up is some of the Bernie Sanders infrastructure that is lining up behind the candidates. Two names behind Ro Khanna, who, by the way, is a very big deal. Ro Khanna's been out there, particularly on the Epstein front. He's been one of the leaders on holding people accountable about the Epstein matter. But he's got like Julian Mulvey, who did ads for Bernie Sanders, with him. Jeff Weaver, who was the chief strategist for Bernie Sanders for a long time, has been with him. AOC has got some folks with her too. Mike Koska, who's her chief of staff now, who had been with Bernie. And then Shakir, who also is with her and one of Bernie's foreign policy advisors, Matt Dust. So I think, you know, the Bernie land, for lack of a better term, does seem to be splitting up between these candidates, and we don't really see a wholesale movement. The question will be, where does the man go? Right? Like, who does Bernie sort of tap on the shoulder and say to everyone, this is my gal, this is my guy?
Yeah, and I think it'll be really interesting to see whether he does sort of anoint his follower, because I think, you know, the odds-on favorite for that obviously has been AOC for the last few years, but I think there is a bit of a fracture within that left base. You know, she hasn't been as out there the last year and a half. She has, I think, smartly, you know, tacked not to the center, but, you know, she's played a pragmatic inside hand over the last, you know, since 2018, and that has disillusioned some of those folks. You know, I don't think that that's necessarily going to dissuade Bernie Sanders from putting his thumb on the scale if he thinks that that's the right way to hand off the movement. But, you know, and not to compare him with Trump, but he does have like a similar quality where it's like he's 85. If he really wanted to anoint his successor, he could have done it already. And I don't get the sense that he's super eager to like pass the torch in such a clear way that says like, now AOC will carry this forward. My time has come and gone, you know? So it'll be interesting to see if he weighs in at all.
Well, Matt, don't you think one of the things that made people nervous about Bernie Sanders was that he wasn't just at war with the Republicans. He was at war with the establishment of the Democratic Party. I mean, he said it himself. I think he won that primary in New Hampshire. And he said, you know, first thing we're going to do is take out the establishment, which a bunch of Democrats went, wait a minute, I think he's talking about me. And so that was nerve-wracking. But what AOC did was, as Jesse was just saying, she decided to go a little bit more pragmatic as she stopped running campaigns against incumbent Democrats and started being focused her, you know, on Republicans and what they were doing wrong.
Yeah, I think it's a much more interesting tact. And like Jesse says, it's not really to the center, but it's just more of kind of a practical approach to it. You know, Bernie, like the thing about Bernie was Bernie had nothing to lose. Mm. Like he never had anything to lose. Nobody expected him to do anything in 2016. He was an afterthought for the Hillary campaign until he really started to come on and was forced to deal with. And, you know, in 2020, like he almost won the nomination, he like did. Except for a couple of deals that Joe Biden cut. You know, he would have. He, you know, he really scares the centrist and kind of institutionalist Democrats. I mean, I don't think he necessarily needs to, but AOC has definitely tried to like assuage some of that concern, play a little bit more inside of the lines while still holding a very strong value based kind of philosophy. And, you know, she's not going to cave, I don't think, on her kind of principle of values of protecting workers, you know, going after people that are ultra wealthy and like trying to do something about the wealth gap that's been created in this country. So I think she's smart. I mean, look, she's clearly super smart and is really good at what she's doing.
So Jesse, if we stay on this lane, let's get Bernie adjacent now. Let's start talking about maybe some of the other candidates that are out there you've been paying attention to. I think the three that are, you know, that people talk about a lot are J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, who's also a billionaire. I know people will hold that against him sometimes. And then Josh Shapiro, who's the governor of Pennsylvania. The two of them are running for re-election this year. I just want to throw one more in the mix if we're talking about the Bernie adjacents, which is Chris Murphy, the senator from Connecticut, who seems like, you know, he grew a beard. He doesn't wear a tie. He's kind of, you know, he's showing up like he's thinking about 2028. What do you think about any of these other candidates?
Yeah, look, I think they're each have their own strengths and weaknesses. I think like one of the things that is interesting about both Murphy and J.B. Pritzker were among the earliest, you know, out in 2025, kind of taking the like burn it all down, fight as hard as you possibly can approach. And I think they, on the one hand, that clearly earned them some accolades, and you know, the progressive left seems to be giving them some more serious consideration than a Josh Shapiro or a Gavin Newsom. You know, so I don't think it was totally without benefit, you know, but it does strike me that neither of them have really registered in these way too early 2028 polls, and kind of, you know, everyone has moved in that direction about fight as hard as you possibly can. And so there may be diminishing returns. And I kind of think this is a problem you're going to see for, you know, similarly, Ro Khanna has had about as good of a 18 months or whatever as you can imagine, you know, leading the Epstein files, Transparency Act, and, you know, just being ahead of the curve on calling, you know, Gaza genocide, all of these things that you'd think he would be kind of blowing up and still not really registering on the national polling level. And so I do kind of wonder whether, you know, whether those guys are going to have trouble making real inroads with voters.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it was, as we talk about, the last member of Congress that was elected to president was James Garfield. So I don't know that Ro Khanna is the next James Garfield. But, you know, I think with J.B. Pritzker, you know, the one thing that he is doing is, I agree with you, he is way down, like, you know, he's like 2.5% on Kalshi. Like, he's like not, he's registering the 1% and the 2% in polling. You know, but he hasn't really started to run yet. He is running for governor. He needs to win that re-election. He's done a couple of interviews, which is very clear that he's going to run in 2028. The distinguishing factor for him, though, is he is the one person that has said, I think we should be trying to do universal health care. And he raised the minimum wage in Illinois and says we should have a federal minimum wage up to 15. And not everybody else is saying this. So his messaging that he is already positioning himself is to be to the left of all of the other centrist candidates. And so if AOC doesn't run and Ro Khanna is you know, fine, like running in that lane. I mean, there is, I think he could come in and swoop in and take a lot of that energy. And he seems to be like an authentically good person. And the people who work for him really like him, and he like shows up and he's got a pretty good story. So anyway, you know, if he can get over the billionaire thing, like I think that'll be work against him, but he also has $1 billion. So he is gonna, if he wants to run until the convention, he will be in the race until the convention. Like money is like that. And that is a huge factor for this.
It's true, yeah. As Matt knows, the only thing that ever kills a presidential campaign is running out of cash.
Money. Yeah,
totally. I think those are all really good points about Pritzker. And, you know, I lived in Chicago for 8 years. And I think another thing that's, I mean, as you mentioned, kind of, he has an actual governing record. I think it's going to be a lot easier to be running as a governor in this moment and be able to point to, 100%. All of these Democratic priorities that he's been able to enact because they have, you know, Democratic supermajorities in both houses of the legislature there. And it's also given him an opportunity to, there was a lot of skepticism when he ran in 2018. You know, he was not super well known. Yeah, I mean, they've got their name on a lot of buildings and whatnot in Chicago, yeah, and Illinois. But, you know, people were very, the left in particular was very skeptical. And now he's had almost a decade to prove, like, yeah, I might be a billionaire, but just look at what I've done. And he's won over a lot of the left. So I think it is a unique portfolio you're going to be able to put together. It's like, I'm a good governor. I've done a lot of real things. Just look at what I've done. And I'm super progressive. And I can drop $500 million of my own money to make it to Iowa or whatever.
Yeah. Jesse, you know, you posted something on your newsletter, a recent poll. And the one that jumped out at me was, by a 2-1 margin, Democrats prefer someone they see as fighting to get things done over someone they agree with on the issues, which then kind of argues whether or not, you know, really where people stand on these big questions of, like, you know, universal health care or, you know, the climate change or, you know, any of these other big questions, what they really want is somebody who can get up in these Republicans' faces, right, and really push back and fight.
Exactly. And I think to fight effectively, too, because I think there was a lot of, there was kind of like, I think back to the Cory Booker 25-hour speech, which was like a truly incredible accomplishment from a biological standpoint. but like, he was speaking about real things. He wasn't doing the Ted Cruz reading Cat in the Hat thing, you know? And like, it was super inspiring. And I think people were desperate to see a fight in that moment. And at the same time, there was kind of this like second moment after that where people were like, but like, what are we accomplishing here? And again, it's not any fault of Cory Booker's or any Democrat in Congress, but there's just very little that you can actually get done to show that you're not just a fighter, but someone who's fighting effectively to deliver for people. So I really do think that puts the governors in at an advantage. The other thing that I think is super interesting about the ideological question, and I do think this will actually make it a lot harder for someone to just kind of carve out that left Bernie lane, is that, like, you know, the consequences of winning the argument on a lot of these issues, the base has moved so far to the left, and your standard run of the mill Democrat is now, you know, saying all the same things about Israel and, you know, progressive populist economic policies. And it just makes it a lot harder to be like standing out as, oh, yep, I support a $25 minimum wage and I support abolishing ICE. And you're like, well, that's kind of mainstream Democratic policy now.
Yeah. Right. Even Rahm Emanuel now is questioning military aid to Israel, which is
right. Yeah, exactly. It's done. Right. That's done on the Democratic side, clearly.
Yeah. But you did also in that poll was, people do want Democrats to be pro something. I was thinking about this because a year ago, one of the things you heard the most from Democrats was they felt like they were Democratic, not Democratic electeds, but just Democratic voters. They felt like the party was laying down. The party wasn't really fighting back. And I think Cory Booker, for what you just said, one thing he did was he started to like energize this idea that Democrats were fighting. And I think we have to give also, we don't hear this a lot, but I think we have to give Hakeem Jeffries credit, because the Democrats fighting into the government shutdown said that Democrats were fighting for something. They're willing to stand up and push back, and they nominally, you know, maybe even won the arguments in those shutdowns in a way that I think most voters didn't expect to see Democrats have that kind of fight in them.
Yeah, and I think there's two parts of it, right? Like, one is the fighting, and the second part of that, though, is having an affirmative agenda. And I still, you know, I've consumed over 1,000 hours of podcast hits from all these people, and I'm still kind of left oftentimes waiting, like, They love to say, oh, we can't just be against things. We have to be for things. And then I'm like, right, you're the guy.
Those
right.
are. Yeah, so
tell me what you're for.
Right, like what? Just give me
exactly.
a couple.
Right. Exactly.
Perfect. You and, set yourself up perfectly. Go ahead.
Exactly. And you know, to Cory Booker's credit, it's you know, there have been detractors of this policy and whatnot, but he has started to also lay out some big policy ideas. You know, he came out with this proposal
to 70K, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Exempt the first 70K of from income taxes. And, you know, he's talking about an anti-corruption agenda I think he's going to roll out. And I do think that, you know, I don't think the nomination is going to come down to who has the best policy papers, but I do think, you know, I thought Zoran Mamdani is a good template for people, which is like, pick three things that you care about, talk about them in a compelling human way, and be like relentlessly hammering them in a way. You know, people are like, you call and response chants happening at his rallies. We're like, freeze the rent. And like, it's hard to say what those policies are for most of the Democratic Party.
Well, you know, you asked a question in one of your earlier hits that I think is important, which is like, who gets to be a reformer? And are some of these people who have been around politics for a long time, whether it's a Kamala Harris or somebody who's been in the United States Senate for a long time, Pete Buttigieg, who's been the president's cabinet, can they legitimately carry the mantle of reformer into an election where people are looking for somebody who's going to shake things up and not just do what the status quo and elites want?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be really, really hard. And I think it's going to be hard for not just the sort of Biden alums, but pretty much anyone that's been in politics for the last decade plus, you know, and like, I think Buttigieg is a particularly interesting case to me because on the one hand, you know, he's a former transportation secretary of the last Democratic admin. He's very much seen as a sort of, you know, moderate, pragmatic Democrat that kind of codes as like status quo. But like, that's if you go back and watch his 2019 launch, you know, he from the get-go, he was talking about ending the filibuster and, you know, ending the Electoral College and expanding the Supreme Court and like a bunch of really like big, bold, you know, structural reforms. But it doesn't much matter if nobody believes you, you know? So I think like it's got to be a frustrating situation. I know that those guys are going to be going crazy being like, we've been out front on all this stuff, you know, but it's just like, I've said this before, but ironically, I think he'd rather be a 37-year-old mayor from South Bend than a 44-year-old, you know, transportation secretary, because I just think the energy is going to be with the anti-establishment camp.
Well, you know, this goes back to the AOC question, Matt. You've seen this before. Is when it's your time to run, it's your time to run. Like, don't wait. Like, people think they can bank this popularity for later. It almost never works for later, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's particularly problematic for Pete because, you know, this is his time. Now, he's a very young man. And the other thing I think that we wanted to talk about was, you know, Lauren Egan had a piece about how there was, you know, after this Pod Save America disaster of an interview with Ken Martin, you know, that there are people looking for a new DNC party chair. And basically, it kind of like got put on hold because they couldn't find anybody to do it. So I am sure this is going to be incredibly insulting to Pete Buttigieg because he does believe that he is a candidate and a viable candidate for president of the United States. But 10 years ago, he ran for DNC chair. And I think Pete Buttigieg should now step up to be the Democratic chair. We need A players on the field in such a kind of extremely tense time. We are like everything is in the balance right now. So we need people to be up there. Pete would be a fantastic Democratic chair. He is great debating the right. He's a great communicator. He's a decent fundraiser. He has been an executive. And look, I know he would rather be president. Everybody would. But the fact is, we need somebody to run this party, to bring the party's brand back into, you know, at least close to positive numbers. It is so toxic right now. I mean, Jesse, you had that polling that shows awful. Anyway, but Pete wanted the job 10 years ago. He got to be transportation secretary. Like, I think it's time he's got to sacrifice. Like, he's got to come back. You know, and look, I think there's some things that Martin could do to probably keep his job, like release the autopsy report. But, you know, I think he's going to have lots of trouble if he keeps going on this path and doesn't do that. So if we need a new chair, I mean, I'm all for Buttigieg being the chair.
It's a great idea. What do you think?
He's got a lot of senior staff parked at Win the Era Pack that I don't think moved back there to mount a DNC chair campaign.
Totally. Look, the DNC chairman's got a big budget. Those guys can get taken care of.
It does. No, they could all get taken care of. But look, I think he'll be completely insulted because he is a legitimate presidential candidate. Although what I will say is, if you're looking at polling right now and people are asking kind of who you think should win, I mean, Gavin Newsom, Kamala Harris, they're polling, AOC are all polling ahead of him, and he's run for president before. And like, if your name is not like way up there, like, I mean, people know you. Like, it's not like you don't have like a J.B. Pritzker problem where like most people don't know who you are or, you know, so I don't know that his path is to the White House. Like, so, you know, and look, he's young. He could be the DNC chair for 6-8 years and then go try to run for president later on. So I don't know, but I think that's what we need as a party. And I would hope that he would step up to do it.
It's interesting. Mitch Landrieu is another person who,
oh yeah,
a Biden admin figure who people had hoped would step into that role because he's such a phenomenal communicator.
He'd be good too. It'd be great.
He'd be great too.
Yeah, no, Mitch is great because Mitch also has credibility to go places. He's one of the few, frankly, like big white names, right, that African Americans feel like a great affinity to, having taken down statues in New Orleans. And so he's super comfortable like in every environment. And so I think he is one of those people that people, you know, that would be great in this party. So, you know, we'll see. Okay.
Yeah, I think, I'm on record on this show that I think for the basics, Ken Martin has done a pretty good job of. They've raised enough money. No, they haven't raised the most money, but they've done a great job funding state parties and getting infrastructure ready. Like, that's what he's supposed to be doing. But he's just this autopsy report. In the days where like the biggest issue we have is not releasing any of this stuff in the Epstein file, you need to absolutely positively release every piece of information you have, and you can't be seen as hiding stuff. Just get it out, put it out. It's going to suck for 5 days and then it's going to be over. Like, who cares? Like, just get it out and then maybe you can stay. But if you don't put it out, I don't see how he hangs on.
And the thing about it that is just blows my mind, and I basically said this to Lauren Egan, but like he ran for this job denouncing the DNC for doing exactly what he's doing now.
Yes,
in 2016.
Like, put out the 2016 autopsy too. I'm sure it's in some file there. Like, put them both out.
Right. And
who
I was
cares?
Just, I, like, he, Jon Favreau from Pod Save America did this 35-minute interview with him, which I was like, why did he agree to this if he was just going to go up there and keep repeating
I think he thought the talking points were going to like move, and then we're going to move on to what's going to happen in the midterms. Like, he had like two talking points and he had to keep repeating them because John didn't let him up, to John's credit. So, because also the answers don't make any sense.
Don't make sense.
I mean, like, okay, we're not going to release this report because people are going to like point fingers. Like, they're already doing that. And not releasing the report means that everybody's theory on this is valid right now. If I think it's Israel, then I've got nothing to push back on that. If I think that it's Kamala was a woman, like, that's, it's all in there. Like, oh no, we were too left, we were too center. Like, every possibility is alive right now. So put out the autopsy report and at least add some clarity to that.
What many people believe is that the real problem is that it goes after some of the consultants who were a part of the campaign and how much money they made. And some of those people don't really want to be drugged through the mud.
I'm sorry. You made the money. Like, you know, like, deal with it. Like, you know, when you win, you know, you get a house in Tuscany. Like, it's, but, you know, and you get to do, and you get to do international campaigns. But when you lose, you've got to take responsibility. So
I can't wait to win one of those campaigns.
It's
happened.
You could go visit Stan Greenberg's villa in Tuscany. Like, it is, he won a long time ago and he's been making money off of it ever since.
It's true.
I think, like, not to keep harping on Ken, but like, the thing about it that I think is so frustrating to me is that, like, you know, on the one hand, nobody knows who Ken Martin is. Like, this is another one of those sort of insular beltway conversations. On the other hand, it's like the Democratic Party has a massive credibility gap. And when we have a person who runs to be the face of the party promising to do a like deep dive after action report about what went wrong in 2024, spoiler alert, like the biggest thing that went wrong was we lied to the American people saying that Joe Biden was totally fit to be president for four more years. And right. then we were like, just kidding. He's a hero for stepping aside. Kamala Harris is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And it's just like to then perpetuate that credibility gap by promising to release this autopsy and then totally reversing course and pretending like you're doing exactly what you promised you were going to do. Like, what are you talking
about?
Yeah,
the dissembling was off. He even dissembled in the interviews, like, oh, we're going to release the executive summary. Like, oh, no, the recommendations are the executive summary. Like, come
right.
on.
And like, I agree with you that he's done, like, I think it's good that we're putting more money into the state parties. Like, he's done some things well. I'm not just trying to, like, dance on Ken's grave here prematurely. But, yeah. like, you know, I think let's not also mistake winning 2025 and 2026 elections that are a referendum on Trump as proof that the Democratic Party has figured it all out. Because as you mentioned earlier, like, the brand is still super toxic and we haven't solved all those problems just because Mikey Sherrill and Abigail Spanberger won big, you know, elections in 2025. Like,
yeah, I mean, the wind is blowing in the Democratic direction because of Trump and it's like complete and total incompetence. Like, so he can get some credit for it, but he doesn't get to claim all the credit for it.
Totally.
Jesse, I have one question for you before we go. You've been following a lot of these campaigns and potential candidates. Have you detected any sense of someone who is getting a lot of either requests to be some places or is showing up places in more frequency than the others? Who are the most popular of the potentials that are out there?
It's interesting. It's such a good question. I mean, it depends on the kind of state or district that people are running in. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's a lot of interesting, like, I call them the crossover candidates. There's some, like, union, like, Bob Brooks in Pennsylvania 7 and Sam Forstag in Montana. Like, there's some of these, like, Rebecca Cook, who's running against Derek Van Orden, and those candidates, they are both touting Bernie Sanders' endorsement and touting, like, the Pete Buttigieg endorsement. But when you're looking at, like, there was a Miami mayoral race. The Democrats flipped the Miami mayoralship for the first time in 30 years. Yeah. And, like, they don't want the socialists in Miami, I'll tell you that much, you know. But I think Buttigieg, Shapiro, Westmore, like, some of those sort of centrist super communicator types, those are the ones I've seen most frequently. I think Gallego in some Latino heavy districts has been a more recent person, you know. But it is interesting to see who they want to bring in, and in some of those, like, white working class areas, it's interesting to see the Bernie, you know, they'll tout the Bernie endorsement and tout the Pete endorsement and kind of not some of the more mainstream establishment Dems.
Yeah, this is one of the things I will be paying attention to, because I remember back, you know, all the way back when Obama was running in 2008, he spent the 2006 cycle, like, basically going to, like, 38 different states or communities, like, doing races, doing public events, really inviting people. Hillary Clinton was doing fundraisers more, not doing a lot of public events. She wasn't getting invited to some of the new interesting places. So it'll be interesting to me, like, for instance, my old boss, Kamala Harris. How many people will invite Kamala Harris to vote, to campaign with them in 2026? I think that will give us a great marker of, like, her sellability across the board. You know, does she primarily go to, like, kind of, you know, more liberal progressive places? Like, do we see her a lot in Maryland, right? Or in Philadelphia? Or will we see her also campaigning, you know, places that are a little bit more unpredictable? Will she show up in Iowa, let's say?
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting. Like, remember there was that Tennessee special where Afton Bain was running in a Trump plus 22 district or something, and I saw Kamala was in town already for, you know, doing a book tour event, and she tried to be helpful, but without ever actually being on the stage at the same time as Afton Bain, which I thought was smart. But Ken Martin also went down there, and I'm like, what are you doing? The last thing you want to do is make this a national referendum on the Democratic Party.
Right.
But I do think Kamala is, I think she has some political weaknesses, but I do think that her stock is being underrated in the 2028 conversation because she's at like 50% support with the black vote, which, as we know, like black voters in South Carolina have like pretty much determined the Democratic nominee dating back to, you know, Jesse Jackson. Like, it was the last time that they broke from who the eventual nominee was. And nobody else is even registering, you know, and people are just kind of writing her off because they, you know, 2024 obviously didn't turn out how we wanted it to. But I think it would be a mistake to declare her political career over here. She's got some unique strengths that others don't have the ability to compete with.
Oh, I think that is absolutely true. Question will be, she'll get the oranges. She's got to be able to make the juice, right? And I think that's the question people will have to see see whether or not that happens. So the one person, he's running in this race, so he won't be this year, and I don't think he's running for president. I do think one of the most popular Democrats after this cycle might end up being someone like Tallarico. I think James Tallarico will be seen almost like Buttigieg was a little bit after his DNC race. You know, he may not have won, but he brought himself onto the national stage and he didn't go anywhere. I think Tallarico's here to stay.
Even if he loses, you think he's here to stay?
Even if he loses, I think he's here to stay. Because I think his voice as a Democrat who's arguing for progressive policies based in a faith-based manner is a way that Democrats have to learn. For years, Democrats have got to learn how to talk to white people on Monday the way they talk to black people on Sunday. And when Democrats go into black churches, we talk about faith and values and what we stand for. They're very heartfelt arguments. And then on Monday morning, we want to issue policy papers and have intellectual debate. We've got to talk more about our heart and our foundations. I think Tallarico is learning how to thread those needles.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if Andy Beshear can make a play in that lane as well. He's someone else who, you know, talks about his faith informing his why for running for office here. And he's definitely running in 2028.
For sure.
He's made that pretty clear. Yeah. But I think it's a totally right about Tallarico that even if, especially because it's such a long shot race in theory that like if he loses by one or two points, he's still going to be viewed as a superstar. And, you know, I wrote this thing in last year before all the Plattner Nazi tattoo and Reddit post stuff came out that about Tallarico, Plattner, and Mallory McMorrow saying like, should these three like rising stars just be running for president in 2028? Because it's going to be super hard to like win one of these races and then turn around and immediately start running for president. But I do think there's such a hunger for that outside voice. You know, you obviously saw Zoran Mamdani sweep in out of nowhere. And I was thinking this as I was reading the Natasha Karecki's piece in NBC that we were talking about earlier about the progressive lane. It's like, maybe it's none of these people and it's Sean Fain from the UAW or John Stewart, or it's, you know, there are some other, I think there is a lot of room for there to be brand new voices that feel more potent in 2028. And I agree, Tallarico will be, I don't know if he'll be a presidential candidate, but you can bet everyone will want his endorsement and people will want him on the stump for them.
For sure. All right. Well, this was fun, Jesse. We have to do it again. Thanks for joining us.
Yep. Thanks for coming on.
Anytime. Thanks so much for having me. You guys are doing awesome work over here. So I tune in every week.
All right. And we will listen to Nobody Knows Anything, which is the podcast. And I'll keep checking in.
And thanks for cutting down. Your last three episodes have been like an hour each as opposed to an hour and a half each. It like makes it like I had to binge them to get through on the end and like made it way easier. So that's good. That's gotta be easier for you too. Yeah.
I told Rob, even my wife won't listen to me for 90 minutes. So.
Well, I think that's true for a lot of us.
The amount of work you guys are doing is great, though. So it's really impressive. So and the big, beautiful tracker is, I mean, it is big and it is beautiful. So I'm incredibly impressed you were able to do it.
Appreciate all of that. You guys are crushing it. So thanks so much. We'll have to have you over on our side of the wall.
We're happy to come whenever you want us.
Love to do it. And if anybody out there wants to be in touch with us, please email us at blaze@trailblazepod.com. We look forward to seeing you all next time.